This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. It's 6 minutes after 12, and this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, May 6th, 2019. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ahead this hour, the Bentonville Film Festival is returning for its fifth year. One of the films examines Japanese internment camps in the United States during World War II. We'll have that story later this hour. Coming up after Ozarks at Large, it's NPR's Here and Now. Until the Pulse nightclub massacre, the worst attack on gay people in the U.S. was at the Upstairs Lounge in New Orleans in 1973. After the club was set on fire, survivors worried about the fallout. You can hear more about this story on today's edition of Here and Now. That's from 1 to 3 o'clock this afternoon on KUAF 91.3. Tonight, the U.S. Marshals Museum welcomes Governor Asa Hutchinson for the conclusion of its annual spring lecture series, Power and Politics, Know Your Arkansas State Government. During his presentation, Governor Hutchinson will highlight the impact he has in regards to specific legislation as the state's highest-ranking official. He will also address how he handles the budget and funding priorities of the state. The lecture will take place from 6:30 to 8 o'clock this evening at the Blue Lion at UAFS downtown. Tickets are $10, and more information is available at usmmuseum.org. The Washington County Sheriff says time is slowly running out for the Quorum Court to make a decision about whether to ask voters for a jail expansion. Jail staff say there are 40 to 50 inmates who have to sleep on mattresses on the floor because of the lack of beds in certain areas. The sheriff has proposed expanding the 710-bed facility by 600 with the addition of a new pod. But as Ozarks at Large's Susanna Sitek explains, some residents and local advocates oppose the idea.
To be honest with you, I don't have a good feel right now. I don't know. I think they all would agree that we're overcrowded, that we're going to have to do something. What is that something? I think that we're still in debate over.
That's Washington County Sheriff Tim Helder, and he's talking about the 15 members of the Quorum Court, 9 of whom were sworn in 5 months ago. That means the court looks very different than it did last year when Helder started presenting his plans for expanding the detention center.
I've been doing this a long time, and I know what our needs are. So I'll stay the course that we've got to have the facility. We've got to have, let me put it like this, in order for law enforcement to remain effective throughout Washington County and regionally, we've got to have some place to put people that are breaking the law. We're out of room.
The $38 million jail expansion would be funded by a half-cent sales tax. After construction is finished, the tax would drop to 0.25% to fund operations. That's on top of the existing quarter-cent sales tax used to fund the operations of the current facility. Voters would have to approve the expansion and new tax in a special election.
My responsibility is being that lone voice in the wilderness, letting people know what's happening and that we better do something. And then if the people don't want it, the weight of the world's off my shoulders. I'll have done all I can do, and then future administrations can deal with it. But I certainly don't feel comfortable kicking the can down the road intentionally and not trying to deal with this now.
But before it can get to voters, the approval of the special election has to get through the jails, law enforcement, and courts committee first. Then it has to go before a full quorum court, which has been hearing from a growing grassroots campaign that's urging the justices of the peace to consider more alternatives to incarceration to reduce the jail population instead of expanding the facility. Sarah Moore, who lives in Fayetteville, is part of that group.
I don't know that anybody in our county can afford to have another tax increase to this degree. But you know what? Maybe it's something that's a few million dollars, and maybe that's a little more palatable for our county. We don't know because we haven't done the studies, we haven't brought the right experts in, and we haven't had a full enough dialogue to really know that at this point.
Moore and other members of the campaign, like John Comstock, would like the dialogue to include a discussion of reforming the bond system so it doesn't disproportionately punish those who can't afford bail.
National studies have told us that the bail money itself has nothing to do with whether or not a person comes to court. It really doesn't. What decides whether you come back to court or not is who you are. And guess what? Most people in Arkansas come back to court.
Comstock is a former Benton County Circuit judge. He says he's dealt with both types of defendants, those who can make bail and those who can't.
And over time, I became convinced and remain convinced today, not just from my experience, but from literature and from talking to experts in the field, there is no difference between these two groups of people, with the exception of one is too poor to make their bail. Now, yes, there will be a handful of people that are the types of individuals that we might say need to be in custody and detained. But that's the exception, not the rule.
Washington County Prosecutor Matt Durrett doesn't see it that way.
A lot of people are under the impression that that the sheriff's office is, or that the jail is filled with just poor people who can't afford their bond. And I understand that sentiment, but based from where I'm sitting and from my viewpoint, I don't think that's true.
Durrett says right now the jail is releasing about 200 low-level nonviolent offenders a month on their own recognizance instead of bail to manage the overcrowding.
The last thing that we want is someone to be in jail simply for no other reason than they can't afford the bond. Some bonds are put in place or designed to be high for specific reasons.
That includes offenses like murder and rape, but also ones like failure to appear, which Sarah Moore says many people commit because of extenuating circumstances.
They have to rely on rides. They relied on the bus system. If the bus doesn't run at the appointed time, they miss the one bus. They can't get to court. Some of these folks are in poor health. So there are some additional barriers because of people's economic standing within the community that we need to address as well.
Durrett says the prosecutor's office already works with defendants who are in those situations.
Simply because someone is in on a failure to appear doesn't necessarily mean that it means they missed their court date. But that's one part of a failure to appear. We've got to show that this was they willfully skipped a court date as opposed to they couldn't get transportation or they forgot their court date. They thought it was next Wednesday instead of this Wednesday, because we get calls like that all the time.
Another member of the grassroots opposition, Beth Koger, says the sheriff's office should also consider ending its participation in the 287G program, which identifies inmates who may be subject to federal immigration laws, as well as Act 309, which houses state prisoners in county jails to work.
Another area where we disagree on the bed space is right now we house federal prisoners and we house prisoners from Madison County. We should not be housing prisoners that we don't have to house. We should take care of our people first.
John Comstock says he'd also like to see the county expand its use of drug and veterans courts as diversion from prison and to consider adding a mental health court.
How do you grow those two courts? And you grow them in a couple ways. One is they need some additional staffing. They need some professional counselors. They need funding for those positions. The county could do that at a whole lot less cost than what it's going to cost to build a $38 million, jail complex.
Comstock says the county could establish a committee to study and implement these and other creative alternatives before asking residents to approve a jail expansion.
Now there are a bunch of folks in Washington County whose attention has been focused on this, and they want to be part of a solution. They're not here to be obstructionist and to say we're against the jail expansion. They're just saying, hold it, let's not impose this tax burden on us. And it's not just a tax burden. It will devastate additional families and individuals by the incarceration needlessly.
Prosecutor Matt Durrett says he believes county officials are doing what they can.
We're still open to suggestions because at the end of the day, we want to make sure that if you're going to put it to a vote of the people, that everyone knows that the sheriff's office and everyone involved in this process has done everything we can to free up space, to make sure that this is the option that's the last resort.
And Sheriff Tim Helder adds, many of the alternatives that have been suggested are not something he alone can do.
Whenever you start talking about these different programs, they don't come from me. They come from the circuit courts, they come from state government, and they come from a broad range of involvement from, community partners. So where this is going to end up, I'm still somewhat optimistic that reality is going to set in at some point. Hopefully it's not too late, so we're so far behind that we can't catch up.
Helder says that could mean federal court involvement and mandates if the overcrowding leads to safety concerns for those inside the jail. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzanna Sitek.
The jail's Law Enforcement and Courts Committee meeting was planned for this evening, but was canceled after the sheriff was unable to attend because of a previously scheduled charity golf tournament. The next meeting of the committee will be June 10th.
The Bentonville Film Festival and visitbentonville.com present the 5th annual Bentonville Film Festival, May 7th through the 11th. Attendees will enjoy film screenings, panel discussions, community events, free movies in the park, biking, and more. BentonvilleFilmFestival.com for tickets and information.
This is Ozarks at Large. Meal vouchers are now available for University of Arkansas students in need. The Volunteer Action Center, the Associated Student Government, and Chartwell's have partnered to provide the new hunger alleviation program on campus. Last week, Claire Allison, assistant director at the Center for Community Engagement at the U of A, stopped by Studio 123 to discuss the voucher program.
The meal donation program has existed in a couple different forms over several years, and the Associated Student Government has sponsored it in the past in partnership with VAC, and the presidents of those two organizations this year, that's Aaron Farmer with VAC and J.B. Gerhand with ASG, just really took it on as an initiative this year. They really wanted to see it revived and strengthened and, you know, create a legacy to carry it on even after their terms. So they really took it on this year. You know, I advise Erin in her presidential role at the VAC, and I know that they just really saw it as a way for students to learn more about the issue of food insecurity on our campus and then also have an easy way to take action to help their fellow students get the meals that they needed.
So existed before, so how is it going to exist now in its current form?
Yeah, so this semester, Chartwell's opened up a two-week period of meal donations and helped promote it. You know, all three organizations really reached out to the student body and to meal plan holders to ask them to donate, ask them to you know, to participate and just to help them learn more about the initiative. So in those 2 weeks, about 951 meals were donated, and those are meal swipes that were donated, and some organizations also made cash contributions, some student organizations on campus. So those 951 meals will be distributed through the Jane Beeger Heart Full Circle Pantry and through various other student support offices on campus. And we hope to at least be able to do that next year. And I know that there have been talks about, you know, expanding that in some different ways.
Any requirements or just simply asking?
Really just asking. You know, we are verifying just student status because that is the focus of the program. But, you know, we're really just trying to make these available to anyone who might be experiencing a variety of crises. Because, you know, students in need can look really different. You know, some students have, you know, ongoing need if they're self-supporting, trying to make ends meet, trying to, you know, pay all of their own expenses through their college years. Some students experience catastrophic issues, major illnesses, you know, a loss of a job in a family, something like that. So we try to open up the parameters really widely to, you know, be able to just impact anybody who might be experiencing a variety of those issues.
Is this program intended to be used in partnership with the pantry services, or is this sort of a, you mentioned, you know, catastrophic events or something like, mm-hmm. is this mm-hmm. meant more for short term and the pantry is more for long term?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, we're trying a variety of different ways to reach students who experience food insecurity. You know, research conducted in 2016 by my office showed that there's a 38% food insecurity rate on campus. So that's, you know, students, both undergrad and graduates, who have experienced some level of food insecurity in the previous 12 months. And that's a really big number. And we know that, you know, one solution isn't going to fit everybody's situation. And so the pantry can provide, you know, a variety of dry goods. We try to offer as much fresh produce as we can. But a lot of what we offer there is dependent on having a way to prepare it. And not everyone has access to that as well. So, or not everyone has time to prepare it in the middle of their day if they are on campus all day and they need to be able to, you know, eat in the middle of their busy schedule. You know, these meals can really fill in for a variety of needs that maybe the pantry isn't set for, or they can work in concert for folks who, you know, just need some additional support. It is short term. You know, these meal vouchers aren't meant to take the place of a meal plan or anything like that. It is a crisis response, but we hope that it can kind of help get people, you know, from point A to point B.
That was Claire Allison, Assistant Director at the Center for Community Engagement at the U of A. She spoke with me at the Carver Center for Public Radio last week. The Full Circle Food Pantry will be administering the voucher program, and more information is available at service.uark.edu. Students can request meals online, and we've posted a link to that form on our website, ozarksatlarge.com. Arkansas's first medical marijuana dispensary has been approved to open its doors, though it'll likely be about a week before it has product for sale. After being inspected by representatives of Alcohol Beverage Control and the local fire marshal, doctor's orders in Hot Springs Friday was officially given state approval. Scott Hardin is a spokesman for the ABC, which oversees medical marijuana.
Certainly an important day in that the first dispensary can now open their doors for business. As a follow-up, there's a second dispensary in Hot Springs, Green Springs Medical, that will be inspected next week, and it may also receive approval. So we may see the first two dispensaries in the state that open in the same community of Hot Springs.
Hardin says three cultivation facilities are currently growing marijuana, with the first expected to have its first crop ready in the coming week.
KUAF is giving away tickets to the 2019 Rocklahoma Music Festival, held Memorial Day weekend, May 25th through the 27th, in Pryor, Oklahoma. Over 60 acts will perform, including Disturbed, Bush, Jackal, and Ace Frehley. Winners will be announced Friday, May 17th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Information and registration available at KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. This week, the 5th annual Bentonville Film Festival will show documentaries, short films, and feature films. This week on Ozarks at Large, we'll hear from some of the creators of those movies. In the 1940s, more than 13,000 people of Japanese ancestry were interned in Minidoka, Idaho. The site is now a National Historic Site and is the inspiration for the documentary Bamboo and Barbed Wire. The film will be screened twice at the Bentonville Film Festival. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums spoke with director Karen Day about her film, and he has this report.
Karen Day says she wasn't intending to make a movie about the internment camp at Minidoka, Idaho, about an hour from her home in Boise, when she visited the site.
I was making another film called Destination Idaho, and I went to this kind of sagebrush. It is called a National Site of Conscience by the National Park, and it was just really, truly, it was in 2014. There were just a few outbuildings that had not been renovated yet. And since that time, it has really become a place where tourists can go and learn about the internment experience.
She says at its height in 1943, more than 13,000 people of Japanese heritage were kept at the camp. Most of them moved there from the Pacific Northwest. It was one of 13 such camps in the United States during World War II, including two in Arkansas. Day says her first visit to the camp left her shocked.
And I was ashamed about the fact that I had lived in Idaho for 12 years and did not know there was an internment camp. And at my age, I knew about the Japanese-American internment because I had known World War II veterans, not because I had learned about it in school.
She says she had conversations with other people who not only were surprised Idaho had been home to a camp such as Minidoka, but just surprised to learn such camps even existed at all, anywhere. She says she felt compelled to make her 15th documentary about the experiences of people at the camp and similar camps.
If I didn't have this outlet, I'd be standing on a box kind of, you know, holding a sign and saying, the end is near, pay attention, you know. So I have this opportunity to make these great films. And I think that this film, in the end, is something I'm very proud of. I was inspired, I have to say, I was inspired because I spend so much time on social justice issues. I was inspired by the fact that America, from what I've known growing up and how much traveling I've done in places where people are so disadvantaged, the idea of what American democracy is really like the North Star for people in other places where they're oppressed. And my experience from 2016, 2015 forward, when we were, you know, going into this consciousness that we have now of us and them within our country and with the way they think and the way I think, I had seen this, I'd seen repression in a lot of different places, and it made me feel like I had a moral obligation with the skills that I had and the opportunity I had to see this story and know these people, that I had to tell this story. It was like, you know, a kind of pain I couldn't live without. I made it with 11 different brands, three executive producers that are quite generous. They have been executive producers on three of my previous films, and, philanthropists that believe in changing the world. And therefore, I looked at it as an opportunity, you know, like one of those offers you can't pass up.
Karen Day says she feels a sense of moral responsibility with every project she undertakes, but she says passing time pressed her moral responsibility even more for Bamboo and Barbed Wire.
As I met the people, the 90-year-olds that were formerly interned, and I saw that that generation was passing and that there was a code of silence because of Japanese Americans are influenced greatly by Japanese, what they call gaman. Gaman is a Japanese word that means dignity in the face of adversity. And they embodied it so much so that they didn't talk about it. And so as this generation was passing, I felt like I had this incredible opportunity to talk to these people. And much like, not to at all compare myself to Steven Spielberg, but after he had made Schindler's List, how committed he got to work with UCLA to document the Holocaust, the passing Holocaust survivors' stories. There is also the Densho Project, which is headed up in Seattle by Tom Ikeda, and they really have done the same. And I had access to so many wonderful and profound and heartbreaking stories. I felt that if I didn't tell this story, it's kind of like, who will and when?
She will accompany her film to Bentonville later this week. It will be the third time she's had a movie included in this festival. She first came during the Bentonville Film Festival's inaugural year. She says the focus on diversity and inclusion keeps her coming back, as does The Fried Catfish. Like previous visits, she'll watch the movie with audiences and gauge their responses. That, she says, is the very best part of filmmaking.
The rest of it's really a grind, especially the fundraising, the grant writing. But the sitting with the audience and watching them experience it is my favorite part. It's really where I get to feel that's my real payment for making movies. And when people ask me questions, especially in this movie, I mostly defer to the fact that I think it's important to learn the lesson, research what you don't know, and be an upstander. And that's what I feel when I, after the film is finished, to encourage people, especially at Bentonville, that audience, you have a unique opportunity to be examples of being upstanders and inclusion, because you have the great Bentonville Festival right there.
Her movie includes interviews with a pair of familiar faces. One is George Takei, the actor, writer, activist, and social media personality who became famous for portraying Sulu in the original Star Trek series and, as a young person, was interred at Roer, Arkansas. Another interview we'll leave as a sort of surprise. Let's just say a figure of the law who has been the subject of her own recent high-profile documentary and holds a position that would not seem to be easily accessible for a filmmaker. Karen Day says she scored the interview through good old-fashioned connections.
It is all about networking. When you have credibility in your previous filmography of producing films that are come with a message and have legs and get out there, and especially after being, I have worked independently for NBC Nightly News as a war zone reporter, BBC, and so I know a lot of producers, and whether it be TV or television or, television writing or producers for network news, and I had seen this incredible, I call her a liberal icon, and I would have no way otherwise, you know, without an Academy Award to have one of my minions, which I don't have, try to arrange that interview. But it was truly through another producer that I knew who had for BBC who had had access to this great, great person. And it allowed us to have access as well.
Day says her film not only examines how civil rights were viewed for Asian Americans during World War II, but how she sees similar attitudes developing decades later. While she was making Bamboo and Barbed Wire, she met a teenager from Syria who had moved to Idaho just 6 weeks earlier.
Out of Damascus, and she was so brave. She was suffering post-traumatic stress syndrome when she was talking about her experience there, and I was so impressed with her ability to even speak English, but to the courage that it took to speak out while Donald Trump was, at that time, the Republican candidate for president. And she inspired me so much. I became friends with her. I've done a lot of journalistic work in the Middle East. And I wanted to encourage her to keep speaking out. And also, I wanted her to have a good experience of America and what it can be, despite what was happening in the really divisive political campaign at that time, 2016 presidential race. And she, the longer I knew her, the more the headlines seemed to reflect the parallels of the Japanese-American internment and the Muslim experience. The Muslim ban was going on, a protest against it. And she did not. She had no idea about the Japanese-American internment. And that was what was so interesting for her, to have an idea of an American democracy that is stellar and promises so much, and at the same time to learn about this part of history and see, you know, be exposed to that parallel herself. I mean, I'm being really overly earnest, and I try not to proselytize, but these were, you know, when I got done with this film, I felt like it was an honor to make it because the people who experience these things are the ones that deserve to be honored and definitely recognized for the sacrifices that they made and how they have learned to forgive and move forward.
Karen Day says she doesn't like to use the term hope. She says she believes there is only do, there's no try. But she says her experiences practicing what she calls humanitarian journalism allow her to champion the human spirit.
We have gone through much worse times. I mean, we really have them when we look back, the Holocaust, World War One, the war to end all wars. And yes, I am hopeful. And I think that in the end, Bamboo and Barbed Wire is a hopeful film. And even though I say I'm not hopeful, I couldn't make this movie if I wasn't.
Karen Day is the writer and director of the documentary Bamboo and Barbed Wire about the Japanese internment camp at Minidoka, Idaho. The film is included as a selection in the Bentonville Film Festival taking place this week. It will first be screened Friday afternoon at 3 in the Walmart Museum World Room, located on the Bentonville Square. It will be screened a second time Saturday afternoon, beginning at 12:45 at the Skylight Cinema in downtown Bentonville. A full schedule of the movies and events at the Bentonville Film Festival can be found at bentonvillefilmfestival.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
May 5th through the 11th is National Drinking Water Week. Beaver Water District cleans water from Beaver Lake for drinking. Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, and Bentonville then distribute this water to their customers. More information about Beaver Water District is available at bwdh2o.org.
When you visit the online Encyclopedia of Arkansas History and Culture, you will see the classic parchment page layout, heralding back to 2006 when the compendium went live. But as Ozarks at Largest Jacqueline Froelich reports, the website is undergoing a major redesign.
You can find the Encyclopedia of Arkansas offices in the Bobby L. Roberts Library of Arkansas History and Art on the main Central Arkansas Library System campus in downtown Little Rock. Guy Lancaster, adjunct professor at the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service and a noted Arkansas history author, is editor-in-chief.
Our staff consists of me as editor, Mike Polston as staff historian, Allie Welke as assistant editor, Michael Keycaver as media editor, and Jasmine Job as editorial assistant. We also occasionally have volunteers and interns working for us.
The Encyclopedia of Arkansas project was first initiated back in 2002 under the direction of historian Tom Dillard. The Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation and Arkansas General Assembly pitched in startup funds for the encyclopedia. It took 4 years to launch.
It went live online on May 2nd of 2006, and we had about 700 entries and 900 pieces of media. And since then, we've just continued to grow. We're currently nearing 5,700 entries. We have more than 8,000 pieces of media. And every year, it seems we're adding between 400 and 500 entries. We have yet to exhaust the wealth of Arkansas history. It seems it's like a snowball. The more we add, the bigger we grow.
Lancaster says staff initially authored entries, but most now are written by experts at large.
Our authors encompass a range of people. We have university-level scholars. We have retirees, amateur historians, librarians, students. Basically, anyone can write for us.
And every entry is held to rigorous editorial oversight, he says.
We put every entry through an editorial process that consists of me editing it, our staff historian going over it and sending it outside for peer review, revision, fact-checking, copy editing. And that editorial process continues even after entries are published online. We occasionally get calls for correction because sometimes errors get repeated in historical documents and other works. And if you go back to the original, you can uncover the source of the error. And we endeavor to keep entries up to date, too.
The Central Arkansas Library System has pledged to maintain operations of the encyclopedia in perpetuity, a major commitment and the only partnership like it in the nation. The project also received support from the Arkansas Community Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Arkansas Department of Parks and Tourism, Arkansas Heritage, and private donations.
I don't know if they call that a closed site, but no, we do not advertise on it.
That's Heather Register Sabindin, the encyclopedia's outreach coordinator.
The mission of the Encyclopedia of Arkansas is to provide a free, authoritative source for information about the rich history, geography, and culture of Arkansas for both the people within the state and those beyond our borders who are seeking information about Arkansas.
Register Sabindin says usage of the encyclopedia continues to grow.
Last year, we had over 3.4 million page views. I don't know. I think the visits were a little over 1.4 million.
The current online Encyclopedia of Arkansas opens to faux parchment pages with red graphics and black type. But that's all about to change, says Scott Kirchhoff, creative and digital content manager.
The new one, the one we're about to launch, is much more minimal in terms of its design. It is has bolder colors. It is looks much more like a modern site to me. There's nothing really to say about the design other than it looks new. It looks modern. It looks fresh. And that's what we were going for.
The search function, often used by school kids, writers, journalists, and scholars will also improve, Kirchhoff says.
We do that in three ways. The first way is just by making the search feature obvious and apparent right away, above the fold, as they say. So if you know what you're looking for, you can go straight there. You don't have to worry about what's on the homepage. There is This Day in Arkansas, which is an entry relevant to that day that will appear at random when you refresh or go to the page for the first time. So if you're not sure what you're looking for, you just think Encyclopedia of Arkansas sounds interesting, you'll be immediately met with at least two items that may spark your interest. You can start your deep dive there, or you can just browse the media.
Kirchhoff says the current website doesn't interface well across platforms, including mobile devices, one reason for the upgrade.
So what we've done now is created a mobile-responsive website. So the same website is visible regardless of what device you use to view the website. You can be on a desktop, you can be on a tablet, you can be on your smartphone, you can be on your television if you're broadcasting to your television.
Nathan James is Deputy Executive Director for Technology and Collection Innovation at the Encyclopedia. He says the online redesign is occurring central library system-wide and that the Encyclopedia content will soon be much more portable.
So with the original EOA and the slightly older architecture for that site, it wasn't easy to extract that data and put it into, say, another website or, you know, Facebook. We're just doing that manually. But now we have the option of maybe plugging that data into other websites or letting you ingest it in some way and use it somewhere else.
Scott Kirchhoff says given the scope of the redesign, they had to contract with an adept outside agency.
We have partnered with a wonderful development firm called Few, and they've got some brilliant developers on staff. And they were able to, what we call, scrape all of the data from the old site and do their bit-twiddling magic and turn it into data for the new site.
Nathan James has selected beta partners are testing the new site pre-launch.
And then we are planning to go live on May 15th. So you'll be seeing it a lot more in various places as sort of beta tests until then. On May 15th, the new site should go live.
And Nathan James wants to take the opportunity to say the Encyclopedia of Arkansas welcomes new entries.
There are a lot of entries that we would love to have in the Encyclopedia. In fact, once it's up and running, you can find a page that has all the entries that need authors. So we'd love to have some new folks out there get involved.
Expect the brand new online Encyclopedia of Arkansas History and Culture redesigned to appear on your mobile device or desktop near you May 15th. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Encyclopedia of Arkansas History and Culture is a content partner of Ozarks at Large. You can also find them on Facebook. Special thanks to Anna Lancaster, Butler Center Archival Archivist and AVAR Specialist for her audio assistance with this report.
What is the Sponge Moon? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science, and this is Scratching the Surface. Hyperion is a moon of Saturn, but it's certainly not your run-of-the-mill moon. Hyperion is the largest of Saturn's irregular, non-spherical moons. We also nickname it the Potato Moon or the Sponge Moon. Why? Because the surface of Hyperion is full of holes, giving it a spiky, spongy texture. The size of this moon is actually almost the size of the state of Arkansas. Considering its odd potato sponge shape, Hyperion is probably a remnant of a larger moon that was destroyed by some major impact event. The really mysterious part of Hyperion's heavily cratered surface is that the craters are so deep and so concentrated or squished together that there's really no actual smooth surface or ejecta rays from the impacts. Some of the larger impact craters also show bright, beautiful landslides sliding down into dark and dusty crater centers. We only have a few images from the Cassini mission of Hyperion, but models of how Hyperion came to be are still ongoing. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, or for more segments of Scratching the Surface, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface is a production of 91.3 FM, KUAF, in Fayetteville.
It is Monday, May 6th, 2019, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and I am joined now by Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
So, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I seem to be all right.
Good.
I know you don't remember because you are not Kyle, but on Friday we were talking about the depth and breadth of arts and entertainment offerings on any given Saturday in Northwest Arkansas.
So much.
Which on Saturday included like everything from a motorcycle rally to the Rite of Spring played by the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas. The May Festival of the Arts in Eureka Springs has kind of been doing that for a while all on its own. And a lot of it's been visual arts, but lately, they've added other things, like they're going to have a fashion show.
Oh, with fun.
Fashions by Rosie Rose. And they're going to have a juggling festival.
Mm.
Galen Harp, you pretty much know in Northwest Arkansas. If you've ever seen anybody juggling, that would be him. He's the co-founder of the Institute of Juggleology, which I just want to say three or four times. He's placed in the International Juggling Championships, and now the Northwest Arkansas Juggling Festival is part of the May Festival of the Arts, and it happens the 10th through the 12th. They're going to have classes. They're going to have demonstrations. He says he taught himself to do the Japanese chef tricks when he was a kid, and it kind of went from there.
What are the Japanese?
Like when you go to Shogun and they throw the...
Oh, okay.
And so they invite both experienced jugglers and those who would like to learn more to come to what they call an open gym, which is from 5 to 9 on the 10th. And there'll be like 80 to 100 jugglers there that you can talk to, learn from. It sounds like great fun. And then the morning of the 11th, there'll be another open gym and then classes in the afternoon and juggling-based games in the afternoon. His favorite is called Combat.
Huh.
Everybody starts juggling at the same time, and the goal is to stop people from juggling by any means possible.
Oh, I don't know how I would not probably fare well with
it
that.
It sounds terrifying but fun. And then there's a Saturday night performance at the Eureka Springs Community Center with performers from all over the country. So this is this coming weekend, the 10th through the 12th, and you can find out more by going to Facebook and searching for Northwest Arkansas Juggling Festival.
Okay.
Most of it's free. And then also highlights for the May Festival of the Arts. The 15th, there's going to be a showing of a feature-length film called Antiquities. This is kind of part of the Bentonville Film Festival that they're branching out a little into Eureka Springs and Fort Smith. This happens to have Mary Steenburgen in it and features the quaint and quirky town of Eureka Springs, so it says. This is at 7 o'clock on the 15th in the Historic City Auditorium. On the 17th is the White Street Walk. I love the White Street Walk. This started some ridiculous number of years ago, 28, 32.
Oh, it's been
a while. Remember, but a long time, because four artists who knew each other in Memphis all ended up in Eureka Springs, all on White Street. So they did an open studio. Now it's grown up to not just the people who live there, but like 40 artists that fill every nook and cranny of White Street so you can shop their art, weaving and watercolors and jewelry and pottery, and oh, it's a happy place. 4 to 10 o'clock on the 17th, which is Friday, and then on Sunday the 19th is Books in Bloom at the Crescent Hotel. Also one of my favorite things. This is year 14, and I can't believe that because it seems like it was like 2 years ago they started doing this. They're going to have Brooks Blevins, who is super fun, writes about Arkansas. They're going to have my favorite cat artist. Well, he's not a cat. James Dean, who draws Pete the Cat. Patsy Watkins and Zeke Taylor are doing a new section of the festival for self-published local authors.
Oh, that's fun.
It's all free. You can look at Eureka Springs Festival of the Arts.org or Google Books in Bloom and find out more. And then also this week, Theater Squared continues the legend of Georgia McBride, which I really want to go see. We need to talk about that when we get off the air.
Yes, I do want to go see that.
A comedy about a down-on-his-luck Elvis impersonator who starts doing drag. How can you go wrong with that as a storyline? 7:30 Tuesday through Friday, Saturdays at 2 and 7:30 and Sundays at 2 at Theater Squared. Tickets start at $10 for the under 30 folks. On Thursday, there's three events that you can't possibly get to all of them. Pick. Taste of Art, which happens at the Stone House in Eureka Springs, featuring artwork by John Rankin, who is one of my favorite photographers. 4 to 7 o'clock at the Stone House, part of the May Festival of the Arts. Art on the Bricks is in downtown Rogers, with like 20 pop-up shows. And about the third artist at the revived Zephyr Blevins Gallery at Arkansas Public Theater, Carol Hart, is there this week, 4:30 to 7:30. And then in the River Valley, Eureka has taken over the River Valley, too. Edward Robison, who does the cool, it's not interactive. Yeah, it is. Photography that moves and does Harry Potter sorts of things.
Oh.
Has a show called The Nature of Photography from Traditional to Augmented Reality at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum, and the reception is Thursday from 5 to 7 o'clock, and the exhibit will be up through September 1st. And then on Saturday, I have to throw this one in because I love this event. Kingston is having its 37th annual Fair on the Square, which is arts and crafts and food and music and a homecoming for everybody who ever lived out there. And a parade at noon, and it's just super fun, and I don't know how you're going to do it all.
Okay, well, I guess I'm not, but I'm going to have plenty to choose from.
Good luck with that.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Michael Burks was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, July 30, 1957, and allegedly first held a guitar in his hands 2 years later. His father, Frederick Burks, played bass at clubs at night after working the steel mills. Michael's grandfather, Joe Burks, also played guitar in Camden, Arkansas, where Michael would visit during summers. It was in Camden that Michael was said to have played his first gig at age 6 with his cousin's band. To learn guitar, Michael's father would give him a dollar if he learned a particular blues song in a day. After that study plan worked a little too well, Frederick Burks changed tactics by offering Michael a switchin' instead if he didn't learn a song. The Burks family finally moved to Camden in Ouachita County in the early 1970s while Michael was still a young teen. There, Michael's father established the Bradley Ferry Country Club, a 300-seat venue that hosted R&B and blues musicians such as O.V. Wright and Arkansas-er Johnny Taylor. Young Michael Burks, already long interested in guitar, was soon backing musicians at the club and performing there himself. For around a decade at the Bradley Ferry Country Club and beyond, Burks honed his guitar and performing chops, and he developed a blistering Albert King-inspired lead style and an equally muscular vocal technique.
Not a sign, now it's all of a sudden.
The Bradley Ferry Country Club closed in the early 1980s, and Michael Burks largely left music for more than a decade, working at Camden's Lockheed Martin Missile Component Plant. Following a separation from his wife, Michael moved to Atlanta, Georgia, where one of his brothers lived. An invitation to perform during intermission at the Chick Willis Club date there rekindled Michael Burks' musical ambitions. He returned to South Arkansas, determined to start a new band, and returned to blues music.
Thank you.
In 1997, the debut album of Michael Burks, age 40, was self-released. Called From the Inside Out, it was recorded by Stuart Bayer of Little Rock in the capital city's Quapaw Quarter and featured all Burks' compositions. From there, Burks signed with Alligator Records of Chicago, Illinois. His 2001 album, Make It Rain, drew raves from Billboard and the Chicago Sun-Times, among others. 2004's I Smell Smoke and 2008's Iron Man solidified his reputation through the decade as a forceful blues performer. And, as Michael Burks continued to win accolades, play festivals, and tour internationally, he seemed perpetually poised for something bigger.
I was born down south, raised in the sticks, thinking and playing ever since I was six. To be awful.
Decade seemed equally full of promise for Arkansas-er Michael Burks, with a fifth album ready for summer 2012 release and a full touring schedule, including a June 2nd club date in Little Rock. But it wasn't to be. On May 6, 2012, returning from a European tour, Michael Iron Man Burks died of a heart attack at the Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport in Atlanta, Georgia. Later that month, a public memorial and tribute concert was held for Burks on Bradley Ferry Road in Camden. Michael Burks was 54. In its entirety is Arkansas-er Michael Burks of Camden and Ouachita County with Jammin' at the Wheel from 1997, recorded in Little Rock from his debut album, From the Inside Out. Michael Iron Man Burks of Ouachita County with Jammin' at the Wheel from his debut album, recorded in Little Rock. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
For over 40 years, the stories on Morning Edition have been your stories, your lives, your world.
I saw this man who was
dealing with something. Think I'll be okay?
But suddenly I hear this cute game.
I sat with him on the couch.
This is where, you know, I've been able to come.
And the sound of Morning Edition, it's the sound of you. Listen to Morning Edition every day from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 91.3. This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Hiwassee, a listener-supported service of the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Kyle Kellums, Zuzana Sitek, and Jacqueline Froelich. Additional content was provided by Caitlin Ahrens, Stephen Cook, and Pete Hartman. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of the program. Thanks again for listening, and have a fantastic Monday.